Hello and welcome to another episode of the Mr. Barton Maths Podcast with me, Craig Barton. A show where I interview people who interest and inspire me from the wonderful world of education. Now, this particular episode is part of Season 3 of my Research in Action mini-series, where I interview researchers from Loughborough University's Centre for Mathematical Cognition about their chosen areas of interest and, crucially, the implications for teachers in the classroom. And I try my very best, and regularly fail, not to come across completely out of my depth. Now, for this particular season, we have 6 episodes, and my plan is to release one each week to take us through the summer holidays. So this week, we have the fantastic Camilla Gilmore. Camilla is the developmental psychology and lead of the Centre for Early Mathematics Learning. As I say, going to be completely out of my depth on this one. Now, Camilla has done research for 20 years, focused on learning mathematics, in particular looking at cognitive aspects. Now, long-time listeners may remember that Camilla was on the show way back in episode 151, where we discussed the executive function, and that blew my mind a little bit. Now, just before we crack on, a reminder, and you'll know this if you've listened to some of these already in the series, when recording these episodes, I'd lost my voice, so apologies in advance for the weird croakiness, coughs, and occasional shifts in pitch. Enjoy this one. Well, it gives me great pleasure to welcome, or re-welcome, I should say, Camilla Gilmore to the Mr. Barton Maths podcast. Hello, Camilla. How are you?
Hi there. I'm good today. Thanks, Craig.
That's great. Now, regular listeners may remember Camilla's previous appearance when we did the Research in Action Series 2, I think it was, and you blew my mind about executive function. I was out of my depth there. There's a decent chance I'm going to be out of my depth in this one as well, because I think we're going to be talking about kind of early years and stuff, which listeners know I'm absolutely clueless on. But to kind of build us up to that, Camilla, do you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm a professor of mathematical cognition at Loughborough University. And kind of most relevant for this conversation is that I'm the lead of our new ESRC Centre for Early Mathematics Learning, which is a collaboration across a number of different universities, but is based at Loughborough. And we're going to be doing some new research looking at children's maths learning in the preschool years and the kind of first years of primary school.
Amazing. Fantastic. Right. So to build us up to that, the other thing I wanted to ask you, because you did all your, I put you through the torture of your speed dating questions last time, so listeners can re-listen to that if they want to know what Camilla's favourite number is and why. But what I want to ask instead here is, do you have a favourite failure, something that's not gone according to plan, but you learned something from the experience?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was thinking about this, and last time I talked about a failure of communicating research and about the language that I used. But I thought this time I'd talk about something that's more basic, about a failure of research itself. So a few years ago, I was running a study with Sophie Batchelor, and we were looking at how well people can compare quantities that are represented in different ways. So we were looking at number words, digits, and also kind of concrete representations of number, so pictures of objects. And we had this really complex touch screen study where we were showing lots of images to people, and they had to pick one of each time, and we were recording accuracy and reaction times. It was quite a complex study. And it was a few years ago, so we were doing it on this really big clunky touch screen. It was before you had nice kind of laptop touch screens, so we had to lug this thing around. And we collected loads of data. We saw, I don't know, 40 or 50. It was adults in the first case before we'd gone into schools with this run this study and got all the data. And then Sophie and I got together to analyse the data. And we were actually on our way to a conference. So we thought, oh, this is brilliant. We could sit on the plane and have the fun bit of the end of analysing the data and working out whether we had a very specific question about whether we were right or wrong with what we thought was going on. So we opened up the data file, and it was completely empty.
Oh, no.
And we had forgotten to switch on the setting in the touch screen to record data. So we just had no data. We'd run the entire study, collected loads of participants, and had no data. So it was a really good learning experience about how you have to make sure you test your research processes all the way through. But also it's good to remember that when you start to think you know what you're doing, you can still really mess things up and you
What did
can't.
you do, Camilla?
Well, we couldn't do anything. We had no data. So we actually have never, I've never managed to rerun that study. So it's one in the back pocket that I'd love to do at some point and just do the whole thing again because it was just a complete waste.
Jeez, flipping heck. There we go. Well, I've had that a few times with podcasts where I thought I've covered all bases and either big chunks have not recorded and yeah,
Yeah.
it's a low point.
Well, stuff goes wrong, and actually, it's quite good to make sure you talk to people about that because sometimes I've worked with researchers and they get so nervous if something's gone wrong, and actually, you've just got to tell everyone, well, we all make mistakes sometimes. Things can just go wrong. It just happens.
That's good. Good positive message. I like that. Right. Okay. So let's dive into what you want to talk about. Now you've alluded to this already. CEML. But are you sticking that together? Are you saying Kemmel or are you just
We're
going
going with Semmel. It's not a brilliant
Semmel?
one. We
Semmel.
didn't.
Okay.
Yeah, we spent some time trying to work out a good acronym that you could say in a good way, but we just stuck with a name that made sense. So yeah, it's the Centre for Early Mathematics Learning.
All right. So tell us, this is a new centre, is that right? Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, so well, we launched last summer, so it's a collaboration across eight different universities, and we've got about 30, 35 people involved. And it was set up with funding from the ESRC, and it's a new centre. We've got 5 years of funding in the first instance, and the aim is to do some really good research around early mathematics learning, but also to think about how we can work with teachers and early years practitioners, how that research can have impact on practice and on policy, how we can think about both developing our sort of theoretical understanding of what happens in those early years of learning maths, but also we can think about what matters for policy. We can think about how we develop new resources, and we're really bringing together lots of different perspectives on early maths learning to try and to get a better idea of what's going on, kind of in response to the fact that we know that, you know. A lot of children don't get those early foundations of maths right at the start of their education. And so it would be really good to have a better understanding of what's going on.
That's great. Has this been done before, Camilla? Is this a first, or has there been other similar centres on this scale?
So there hasn't been anything, to my knowledge, focused on maths in the UK on this scale. So there are some other centres internationally, but for the UK, this is the first that I know about that really has that very specific focus and has that extended period of time to do large scale research.
I see. And has this always been an area that's interested you, specifically the early years? Has this been the kind of sole focus for you, or have you kind of fallen into this for a specific reason?
Well, so my research has always been focused on maths learning, and I sort of started out doing various things around primary school, and I've done work on secondary school. I think for me, seeing my own children go through the early years and go to preschool, go to nurseries and things like that, and then start primary school, it did make me realise how much is going on in those years and how crucial they are. So probably for me personally, that's been a bit of a driver.
Now, this is interesting. This conversation could go a few ways here. So I'm going to come across both as an ignorant secondary school teacher. There's no doubt about that. But also, I'm the parent of a 4-year-old and a 1-year-old. And so my little boy Isaac, he's going to primary school in September, obviously for the first time. And he's a real geek like me with maths and numbers. And I just want to make sure I'm not messing him up with a few things. So that'll definitely kind of come into play. But also, as I say, my ignorance from a secondary perspective, this might be the worst question in the world, Camilla, but here we go. Is there a significant difference between early years between kind of key stage one and early years? Would that be it? Are they two separate things? Is there a big jump? Is it as big a jump as there is between key stage one and key stage two, or key stage two and key stage three? Is early years very much kind of standalone in that respect?
I guess it depends on what perspective. So if you're thinking about the child's perspective, the child is just developing and is learning all the time. So if we think about cognitive aspects, so what's going on with their child and their own kind of skills and their kind of mental capacities, that's all very continuous, and there's no distinction across different phases. Obviously, we kind of impose, because, you know, we have to have some structure to our education system, so we impose these different phases. But really, I think what we want to be doing is smoothing across those transitions as much as possible for children. So we don't want things to feel very, very different. But of course, the way that we might find it most effective to do things with children might be slightly different across those different phases. And particularly when we're looking at early years research, I think it's really important to bear in mind what children can do and what they might find difficult in those early years. So we do have to be really careful about taking findings from research with older children and just assuming that the same things are going to apply with early years, because, you know, children, their attention and their memory and things like that are very, very different from, you know, young children. It's very, very different from an older child. So we can't assume that things are going to translate. And it is important. That's one of the reasons why I want to do this centre, is to really focus on the early years. We are including, we're going up to about the end of key stage one, roughly speaking. So we're not just looking at early years in a UK educational context. But yeah, so one of our reasons for wanting to focus on this was actually to say that, you know, we know different bits and pieces about what's going on at those in those early years, but there isn't really good research that pulls these together and actually tries to think about the different aspects. So as in, you know, what might be going on in preschool or in nursery with what is going on cognitively with the child's own development. So trying to bring some of those things together that will help us to kind of have a better answer as to whether we should do things differently across those different phases.
It's fascinating. I should have asked this earlier on, but for the benefit of international listeners, Camilla, who hate it when I start saying things like key stage one, key stage two, and so on,
yes,
could you just clarify what kind of age groups you're referring to when you say early years and key,
yes,
stage one?
So I mean, we're really looking at up to about eight years old, but we're not being strict about this. So there will be some of our research that will go a bit older than that, where it can help us inform what we need to go on. And in terms of that, how young we're going, well, we've got a lot of research happening with sort of 3 and 4 year olds, and we're trying to do some research with 2 year olds as well.
Wow.
Which is one of the things that I'm in the middle of at the moment, and it's good fun, but it's not easy at all.
Flipping it. Well, this was one of the things, and I should have said before, and I've apologized to listeners, my voice is all over the show here. So if I go high, it's not just because I'm getting mega excited or going okay, or anything, I've lost my voice over the weekend. This was something I wanted to, and I don't know how best to phrase this, Camilla, so you'll have to turn this into something that makes a little bit of sense. So if I'm teaching kind of GCSE kids, you know, 15 and 16 years old, their kind of performance day to day doesn't differ kind of all that much. Like if I ask them to add fractions on Monday and add fractions on Tuesday, you know, there or thereabouts, they're going to be at the same kind of level. But I know from having spent quite a lot of time with, as I say, Isaac, my 4-year-old, from minute to minute, he's all over the show. And like you can ask him like whether he's either forgetting things or for whatever reason he doesn't want to do something one day that he did before. Like, how on earth are you doing any for, like you're mentioning 2-year-olds here, like how on earth are you doing any kind of study and research there when I'd imagine kind of performance on a day-to-day basis is so variable? Or have I got something wrong there?
No, you're absolutely right. I think there's two aspects to this. So it's not even on a day-to-day basis. It's on a context-to-context basis.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's, you know, that's the one of the really interesting things about these periods of development. And what, you know, one of the things we want to find out about is how do their skills and their understanding and knowledge, how does that develop and what has an impact on it? And obviously one big thing that we know from research that has impact is kind of the context they're working in. And that's kind of big scale context and small scale context. So, you know, if you're counting dinosaurs and the child's really interested in dinosaurs, they might do really well, and then you go and you count teddy bears, and they're not interested in teddy bears, and they're not engaged at all, and they don't show you what they can do. But also, actually, we know that children's early understanding of number can be quite fragile, and so actually it's a genuine thing. It's not just down to their interests and their engagement, but actually it might be that, you know, they can count objects, but if you ask them to count claps or something that's transient, that they might find that much more difficult or not be able to do it. Or they might be able to count individual objects, but they can't count groups of objects, so they can't tell you how many different coloured objects there are or something like that. And so some of these questions are really interesting questions for research. So they help us to understand what's going on as children develop, how their understanding grows, how they generalize things. And sometimes they might overgeneralize and sometimes they don't generalize enough. But also it does make it is a practical issue as well, that if you do go and see children and the measurements that you make, the tasks that you ask them to do, they do very differently on a day-to-day basis, then it is hard to know how much of that variation is meaningful and how much of it, well, how much of it is, it's usually all meaningful at some level, but how much of it is relevant to the thing that you are studying in that piece of research, and how much of it is kind of incidental. And it's one of the things about kind of having valid measures in research, you know, it's one of the big problems is knowing that you're measuring what you want to measure or what you think you're measuring and not something else. But I would actually also, I would say that the same applies to all kinds of research. It might be that we just assume that we're getting it right with older children and adults. With the younger children, they make it very clear to us when we're not getting it right.
God, this is interesting. I wonder, excuse me, is it possible for you to give us some examples of either some upcoming studies or some that have been done that you've been involved in or are aware of with some of these really young kids? Because whether it's 2-year-olds, 4-year-olds or whatever, just to give us a bit of a sense of some of the things that the centre might be working on.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess focusing on the preschoolers, one of the big things that we're looking at is we know from previous research a number of the different cognitive skills that they need to be able to learn. So we know that they need to know the count sequence. They need to understand cardinality, so how the number, the highest number counted, is the number of the whole set. They need to be able to order numbers, so to be able to recognize whether numbers are in order or not. And those are kind of what we might think of as being these very sort of number specific, domain specific skills. But alongside that, they also need to be able to hold information in mind in their working memory. They need to be able to focus and not get distracted by irrelevant features. And they need to be able to kind of use their language to talk about and to represent what's going on. So previous research has identified all these different things as being important in this preschool period. But what it hasn't shown, or what we're not sure about, is how these things develop. You know, is there a kind of particular order in which they develop? Is it the case that your children really must know cardinality before they can order numbers, or do these things develop separately? So one of the studies that we're doing that we're just working towards at the moment is doing a longitudinal study where we're tracking children's development from kind of age 3 to age 4 to measure their skills. So we've got to get these measurements right a number of different times through that time period, and then we can look at how these different things develop. And one of the things that we're really interested in is actually getting a sense, is it that children typically develop these skills in the same order, or is it actually that there are different potential ways that they can go about this? So, you know, is it very simple that we know that if a child can do this, then the next thing that they need to learn is to do the next stage along? Or could it be that different children, given their different experiences and their different interests, might actually, one child might focus on the magnitude of numbers, while another child focuses first on the order of numbers, and eventually they all need to put these pieces together. So this requires research that tracks children over a period of time, but also includes enough children that we can pick up these differences and actually see whether there are some common patterns.
Jeez, flipping heck. And again, any other kind of concrete examples here?
I think, I mean, one of the things that so far I've mostly been focusing on kind of this cognitive research, thinking about children's individual development. But one of the big things about the centre is recognising that there's so many different influences on children's maths learning. And one of the problems with the previous research is it's tended to focus on one at a time. So you might just be looking at the cognitive stuff, or you might be looking just at the social. And what we want to do in the centre is actually bring these different bits of research together. So some of our other research, again, looking at the preschool period, is looking at children's experiences. So looking at their experiences at home and their experiences in early education settings. So doing some really nice observations. I've got some of my colleagues that have been going in to visit lots of early years settings and doing observations and interviews with practitioners to kind of really get a feel for what does maths in these, you know, what does maths with 3 and 4 year olds in early years settings look like? What's the variety of different ways that settings can support children's maths learning and maths curiosity and development? So we're putting together those kind of more cognitive aspects of children's development with these more kind of social and environmental. And we'll also be looking at home experiences and seeing the ways that parents interact with children and the kinds of activities they do with children and different kinds of games and maths language used at home.
Flipping heck. Lots going on there, Camilla Hay. Jeez. Exciting stuff, but
It is. It's great, but and we're at that point with the centre where we've got lots of things just getting going, so it's exciting, but quite challenging.
Wow. Okay, I want to take us off on a slight tangent here, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So I would say, as a rough ballpark, I'd say maybe 70-75% of the listeners would either be teachers of secondary school, mm-hmm. or probably kind of upper key stage two, but I know we certainly have key stage one and early years listeners, and we've had some episodes in the past with people like Helen Williams on talking about mm-hmm. early years, and I love things that I know nothing about, and as I say, early years is a particular interest of mine for that reason. I wonder if we just talk specifically about kind of tapping into your knowledge of early years and some of the things either that you've found out in the past or are currently working on, because one of the big things that always kicks off on Twitter, of course, is that some policies and techniques and research that potentially would apply to older students just doesn't work when it comes to students of that age. So things like cognitive load theory or the Bjork's work on desirable difficulties and retrieval and so on and so forth. Well, what's your take on that, Camilla? Is that research just not relevant at all to students that young, or are there some key lessons that teachers can take from like Rosenshine's principles of instruction, all these things? Is that just a different ball game, or are there commonalities there?
So I think there's a couple of things here. So as you mentioned at the beginning, I came on before to talk about executive functions because that's a big area of my research. And I do think it's really important thinking about, you know, executive functions that are kind of some of these cognitive mechanisms that feed into the idea of cognitive load theory and that those kind of approaches. And so I do think reflecting on very young children's executive functions can be helpful in the sense of really reminding us how little a really young child can hold in mind. So, you know, typically your typical kind of reception age child, reception or year one child, can only really hold like one or maybe two things in mind at a time. And so, it's very, very easy to overload them with information or to ask them to do things that's going to be beyond their capacities to do mentally without kind of resources around them and so on. So I think it is helpful to think in those terms. And another one that I was looking at some developmental data recently about the development of inhibition skills. So inhibition skills are our ability to ignore distractions, either from the environment we're in or from the information we're processing. And one of the biggest jumps in inhibition development was between the ages of 4 and 5. And so then we're thinking about, in a UK context, you're thinking about a reception year, you're going to have children who are really, really far beyond, behind their peers or far ahead of their peers in terms of the development of these skills, because that's such a massive amount of development happens. And then we're lumping all those children in a year group together. So I think that from that aspect, it is relevant in the early years to be thinking about to think about children's what children are bringing cognitively to the activities that they're doing and where we may need to like modify things. Now, in terms of cognitive load theory itself, this is one of the things that I've always struggled with it a bit, I have to say, Craig. So I'm fascinated by the research and I read the studies and I think, yeah, this is a well-run study. And then I think about what educational experiences can look like and how that just seems to be quite, particularly in the early years, how that doesn't fit always very well with kind of some of the cognitive load theory. And so it is something I've struggled with, but I recently doing more reading and I think what we have to remember is that cognitive load theory is relevant for the situation where we're trying to teach children domain-specific schema. So that's what it's really good at. So if the purpose of what we're trying to do is to teach children particular processes, particular skills, then we might particularly want to be thinking about what cognitive load theory has to say. However, I would argue that most of what happens in early years, that is not the intention. That is not what they're trying to do. They're trying to engage children. They're trying to get children to explore situations, to become, to have positive attitudes to being learners, to have positive, kind of, to develop their social skills, to develop their self-regulation. And yes, to be learning about numbers and maths and exploring with numbers and maths as well. But most of that doesn't, to me, sound like domain-specific schema and processes. Therefore, I feel that most of that cognitive load work isn't relevant to early years, but simply because the intention of what we're trying to achieve in early years is a little bit different. And so so whether or not the principles apply in a cognitive sense with very young children, that's a completely open question. I don't know of any research that's actually done that. So I don't think we can apply the research from older children automatically. But I think even more importantly to me, and certainly in the way that I've kind of rationalized the way that I think about early education with also my knowledge of the research, is just really stepping back and thinking about what is the intention, what are we trying to achieve at these different phases.
Really interesting this. So I can talk with my experiment on my sample size of one on Isaac. Whenever like we're talking about maths and stuff, I'll tell you the bit of cognitive load theory that always kind of springs to mind for me is the notion of extraneous load. So any form of distraction, I am fighting a losing battle straight away. But that distraction could also be if we're talking about numbers, because, and again, I sound like a terrible parent here for like forcing my interest on him, but he genuinely does seems to really enjoy kind of talking about numbers and math. But if I kind of do any form of kind of surface context to the kind of the discussion of numbers, so wrapping up in any kind of context at all, that's all he's thinking about. He's latching onto that context, and to try and drag him back to the numbers is hard work. So it feels to me that, and I always think this with cognitive load theory, you know, out of all the stuff, like obviously, like not overloading students, like that sounds really important, but it's very hard to measure. But out of everything with cognitive load theory, that notion of extraneous load being having no benefit to learning and, you know, only finite attention and trying to get as much of it, whether you call it germane or intrinsic or whatever, you want as kids thinking about as much of that as possible. That feels to me that's something that surely must apply just to everybody, but maybe it's just so obvious it's not even kind of worth considering, and just good teachers know to remove that extraneous load. But I wonder whether that's something that would be perhaps even more important to for younger students, perhaps with their limited attention.
Well, I think, yeah, I guess though that comes back to what I was saying earlier about actually having some awareness of the executive function skills and the limitations of young children is important. I do think that perhaps that is something that people working with young children are so used to what young children are like, and that perhaps that is something that they're just automatically doing without having to think of it in terms of the technical approaches of cognitive load. I mean, I think one thing I would perhaps push back on a little bit is this idea that we need to remove the surface context, because I think if we're trying to get children, let's use numbers as an example. If we're trying to get children to understand what numbers are and what two means and three means and so on, and really to understand those, they've got to do that in the face of distracting information. They've got to see the commonalities across different situations. So actually, yes, they might get distracted if you're, you know, I know there's lots of talk about manipulatives and what kind of manipulatives are good manipulatives, and we could remove all that kind of distracting information and just use counters that are very simple and don't have anything to them. But actually, we need children to be able to see that three dinosaurs is three dinosaurs. You know, and even if they love dinosaurs, I hate dinosaurs, and they can tell you the names of those dinosaurs or whatever, we still need them to be able to see the threeness in that. And not, and if we always strip that surface context away, then we're doing the abstracting for them, and they're not getting that for themselves. So I think there is clearly a balance. And yes, of course, young children are overloaded very quickly, they're distracted very quickly, and actually that's fine, you know, we should let them to follow their interests where appropriate, but let's not take all of that away. And if we remove the executive function demands away from the maths, we remove the maths in many cases. So actually, you know, being able to understand what three is and how it applies in all different situations, and how, you know, it can be three jumps or three wishes or three sneezes, just as well as three objects. It does require us actually to use those different contexts and not just use very simple abstract contexts.
A really good point, Camilla. I'll take that on board for when he comes back from nursery today and it's maths lesson again, I'm onto it. The surface features all over. No, I like that. Another one on the just on the kind of just research and how it applies. Mm-hmm. Can we just talk briefly about retrieval, because I've had conversations heated discussions with colleagues from different phases about this. So again, it would be almost taken as read that it's a good idea at a secondary level to keep providing students with opportunities to retrieve things that they've encountered in the past. And often this will be done at quite a formal level, like the start of a lesson or a weekly low stakes quiz and so on and so forth. Is that just another example of something that's just so blindingly obvious at early years that, you know, if you want kids to remember things, you've just got to keep revisiting them and revisiting them and revisiting them? Is it, would you batch that along the same lines as extraneous load, or is there something a bit more going on there? Does retrieval practice work the same way at early years as it does for older students?
Yeah, well, I find it difficult just to we use these terms and we know what they mean in one context. Yeah. So what retrieval practice could look like in a you know, maths lesson with 11-year-olds, you know, but actually, you know, in early years, it's much more about working with the children's interests, following their interests, and building what they do. And so I think that does happen naturally, because you're building on from where those children are and helping them to explore the kind of next stages of development. So I think it does happen naturally. I don't think we need to create those kind of more formal situations where something that looks a certain way in upper primary or secondary therefore has to look like that in the early years. And actually, it's much more about just from you know previous research with early years practitioners shows that, you know, the good way, it's about careful observations, knowing where the children are and knowing what it is you want to help them to explore next. And that could serve the same function as retrieval practice, but it doesn't need to be thought of as being that or called that, I think. But actually, this is one of the things that, you know, some of our research in the centre is going to be looking at, is the different ways that early years settings and also reception classes and how they incorporate maths in. And actually, it will be really great to see the different ways that early years practitioners are doing this, because I suspect that a lot of this stuff is really happening. It's just not happening under the badge of those same kind of terms that we might use with older children.
Really interesting this. Honestly, everything you say is causing me to want to ask you more questions on this, Camilla. Can we talk briefly about age? Because this is something that interests me a lot here. So this is the most obvious thing anyone's ever heard in their lives. But obviously, a big thing from what I see kind of results at primary school is often influenced by the age kind of makeup of the cohort of students, and you get this notion of the August birthdays, the July birthdays, and so on. And again, for listeners who need it, I'm spelling out here, obviously, like, you could have a cohort of students in reception class, and if that's skewed towards a load of those kids being born in the summer months versus another cohort where they're skewed to being born in September, October, November, those kids are almost a year or three quarters of a year older. So you would imagine that they've developed more understanding, more maturity, and so on and so forth. I just wonder, in terms of your studies, because you've talked a lot about kind of 3-year-olds, 4-year-olds, the difference between 4 and 5, how much does the actual, how far into that year, you know, that age those kids are, how does that kind of get accounted for in the research? Do you have sort of kind of quartiles where you have, you know, 3-year-olds are in the first quartile of their third year and so on? How much do you have to account for the actual age, if that makes sense?
So we tend to use age in months when we're doing research with preschoolers and you know, even later on, because we know that actually it's much, age is continuous, right? So we're not just 3 and then we're 4 and then so on. And it is absolutely, it's one of the most reliable findings, is this month of birth effect, particularly in the early years. And as I mentioned earlier, like, some of this is because some of these sort of these skills that develop and mature regardless of education, but kind of as part of the child's development, they will change so much throughout the course of a year. So children within a year group, absolutely, you will see different levels of development for those who are older and younger, or whether that's you know, across years or across months. I think it's a really tricky one, to be honest. I've become increasingly interested in this. I have 3 kids. My first 2 are September born and my third is July born. And seeing the difference in their experience of preschool, of going to school, is just enormous. And I know, again, that's my sample of 3. But the research, you know, absolutely supports that it is completely different. And I think this is one of the points that I find myself making when we talk about the transition, particularly from reception to year one, so from early years to into kind of key stage one, that if something was appropriate for the reception children, for the autumn-born reception children, then they are appropriate for the summer-born children in year one, right? It's not the case that the minute you move down the hallway or whatever into the next classroom, that suddenly what's appropriate for you is it changes. So, you know, I think we need to look at really good transitions from earlier settings into reception classes, and also from reception classes through to year one, and actually try and smooth those transitions as much as possible, because children will be doing those transitions at very different ages, you know, kind of 20%, 25% difference in their age from some of their peers potentially.
It's fascinating. It goes without saying, you'll obviously know far more about this than me, but my limited understanding of the research in terms of this kind of birth year thing is that even by the time you get to GCSE, it's still pretty significant in terms of the results. And if you look at graphs of this, you can in terms of the results students get at GCSE, it's literally in whichever way you plot it. Mm. September births get the greatest proportion of, you know, higher grades, and then it just goes down with each month that you're born. So I can only assume, well, the 2 questions to this, that obviously it's an even bigger issue in primary settings, and it must just make the job, I mean, you could not pay me enough money to be a primary school teacher, let alone, for God's sake, an early years teacher, but it must make the job of those teachers even more difficult in terms of differentiation and pitch and stuff, when you've got that kind of spread of age distributions. So that's kind of point one. And point two as well is, do you get a sense of how much of this is the old cliche kind of nature versus nurture, that if you've got a kid, two children who are different in age by a month, but as a result of that going to different year groups, does that then mean that they kind of spread apart, not just because of the age that they were born, but obviously because they're then surrounded by peers who are either a lot younger than them or a lot older than them, and then they pick up different things and learn from those? I don't know if any of that makes any sense, Camilla, but I say, it's just an area I'm fascinated on.
Yeah, I mean, so to say, just coming back to the point about how we can detect these effects all the way through education, that's absolutely true. But the when we're looking at GCSEs and that kind of age, we're talking about massive samples. So yes, it's detectable, but it's detectable, the size of the effect is much, much smaller than it is in earlier years and primary school. In terms of, where does this come from and kind of nature nurture and things like that. I mean, I think that kind of idea of a dichotomy is obviously way oversimplified. And actually, there's lots of interactions between the way we develop and the environments we develop in. I think as well, what's interesting is how much kind of more emotional aspects might come in and play a role here. So it might be that actually one of the issues about being young for the year is that feeling of where you sit in comparison to your peers. We know that even really young children, we might try and not label them or rank them or anything, but they know who, they know who's really able to do something in the class and who finds it more difficult. And so they know where they sit, kind of, or often children will have a sense of where they sit. So if you're young and therefore inevitably, well, of course, none of this stuff is deterministic. So you
Sure.
have children born at all points around the year who can do well. But these are kind of tendencies that we see across bigger groups. But for some children, if they start school and they are nearly a year younger than some of their peers, they're going to find some things more difficult. And they might find it more difficult just to sit and listen and pay attention because their attention skills haven't developed that much. But then that can feed into their own sense of their own kind of self-efficacy, their self-confidence and things like that, the way they feel. And then that can then play into back into the kind of the way they are in class, the way they what they think they can do affects how they might engage with the teacher, might engage with other peers and so on. So all of these things are so complex and you've got so many loops and feedback loops and feed forward loops where things can have a kind of unexpected consequences or can have kind of increasing consequences. But I think one thing that is important to bear in mind, so we do see those graphs of the month of birth and things like that. One of the biggest differences on in terms of impact and impact on attainment, we know is socioeconomic status. So we know that disadvantaged children and that the size of those effects typically trump any of these other kinds of effects. So that suggests that actually we know that something about the opportunities that children have both right from the early years, through kinds of activities they get to do, the kinds of environments they're in, is having an impact on their attainment. And so all of these things are kind of interacting and playing in really complex ways, which is one of the reasons why research is really difficult, because in a research study, you're trying to isolate one factor, but then you've got all these other kind of influences that coming into play, and you have to be really conscious and aware of where there might be different factors influencing your results than the one that you were hoping to focus on.
Oh, this is absolutely fascinating stuff, this, Camilla. I've got a few more questions on this, and then I'm going to throw it over to you just in case there's anything else about the centre that we haven't picked up that you want listeners to be aware of. The first is, we'll have lots of parents listening to this who will have kids around about the same age as the kind of students that you're going to be studying from this kind of 2 to late age. Any advice for based on what you've learned yourself and from the studies, any advice for parents for how they can support their students, if we focus, I guess, particularly on maths, to either enjoy maths as much as possible, thrive in maths and so on? What would you say to parents?
Yeah, I mean, the research is does tell there's quite sort of mixed evidence actually as to we do see that there is a relationship between some of the things that are going on at home and children's math skills. What we don't know is exactly like the direction of that causes that, exactly what's going on. But if you want to give your child the best possible kind of start, it seems to it's about positive attitudes to maths, and it's about seeing maths in the world around you. Maths doesn't have to be sitting down and doing something with a book or a piece of paper and a pen. So whatever the age of the children, noticing like mathematical patterns in the world around, noticing numbers in the world around, playing games. Board games are a really good one, and there's lots of research looking at board games and how they can support maths. But maths doesn't have to be an intentional maths activity. It's about bringing it into all sorts of different things that you might be doing at meal times and all different points in the day. So you don't have to sit down and do a maths lesson when they get back from school or preschool, but you could do some cooking, or you could play a board game and snakes and ladders, and, you know, and just thinking, being a little bit intentional about the way that perhaps you're counting on when you're playing a board game. You're not just so imagine if you're playing snakes and ladders and things like that, to actually count on, don't just count 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3 as you move along, to actually see how those numbers grow. But yeah, it's something, but I think we know how much the social influences children's attitudes to math. So I think it would, having those positive attitudes yourself, I guess most of your listeners probably have a positive, relatively positive attitude to maths, but a lot of people in society don't, as we know, and actually trying to make sure children hear positive views of maths, and that how everyone can achieve in maths, and it can be something that they can see themselves as mathematicians and not have this fear of it.
That's brilliant. That's great stuff. And just before the NSPCC get involved here, I'm not going to force Isaac to sit down for his maths lesson when he gets back from this.
But some kids love that.
They do. And he does. He does. He does love it. Yeah. He does love it. I can see the complaints coming in here, Camilla. People, they'll have a go for anything here. So just, I'll put that disclaimer out there. We'll also, I'd imagine, have, as I say, some early years teachers listening, or Key Stage 1 teachers. Any advice from them for those people, Camilla, again, based on what you've learned from years of research into this?
Well, I mean, I think it's sort of the same applies, and it's about having an understanding about some of the complexities of early maths. It isn't just a simple thing, and children are really trying to get these foundations that will set them up well for their maths learning all through their life. I mean, I think one of the things that I haven't really had a chance to talk about yet relates very much to kind of what's going on, what early years teachers are doing. And we're really trying to do, as well as build up our understanding of the theory of what's going on, so understanding how children develop and how things influence their development, actually to think about, well, what does that mean for early years classrooms, for early years settings and primary teachers? And thinking about how can we translate that knowledge of children's development and the things that influence that into thinking about the kinds of activities that children might be doing, and the kinds of resources that have been that are being used in particular. So this is something that we're going to be working on increasingly as the centre grows over the next few years, and actually working very much in partnership with early years practitioners and with teachers to think about, well, what kind of research do we need to get a sense of what these things look like in the classroom? Because actually one of the big problems that I think about our research, and this is not just in early years, this is across maths more generally, is that we might have some really good solid findings from more basic research methodologies, but actually knowing what that looks like when you apply it to the classroom is really, really difficult. And I think there's been a big gap, and one of the things that we're hoping to do some work in is thinking about, well, what we need, a different type of research that might not be big controlled experimental studies, but a different type of research to say, well, what does that now look like in the classroom? And this is absolutely going to require researchers and practitioners and teachers working together to say, well, now we've got a bit of a sense of understanding of the kind of development. How do we develop resources, or what kinds of resources, or how do we help teachers use the resources that they've got available for them in ways that's consistent with the research, but isn't this very simple kind of now we apply it to the classroom sort of idea?
Wow, that sounds absolutely.
So I think essentially what I'm saying is that if there are teachers out there who are interested in that, we're very keen to hear, to get talking to them. And please, we will have more to say around that, even if we don't have a lot right now.
That's brilliant. That's brilliant. Right, I've got kind of two more big questions about this. One of them's horrible, so I'll save that for the second one. So my kind of nicer question is, as a secondary kind of teacher, myself or others listening, Again, in your experience, whether it's from either just classroom observations, talking to early years, whatever it may be, or from the research, is there anything that you think secondary colleagues could learn from the way early years teachers do things?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not a practitioner, I'm a researcher, so I find that quite hard. I try and avoid really ever telling teachers what they should be doing. I think one of the ones for me personally, it's this idea that children might be developing and learning in different ways, and that therefore actually just because children get to an endpoint through a different route, it might not be a worse route to get there. And I think perhaps that's something that certainly in research, even in research with older children, we perhaps don't pay enough attention to the different ways that children can get to the same kind of point of understanding.
Yeah, good. That's good. Yeah, I think I've been guilty of that in the past. Right, here's the horrible question. Okay. And I'm not expecting a definitive answer on this. I'm just interested in your take. I wonder how much, particularly at the kind of age of students that you're studying, so let's say 2 to 8 or whatever, I'm interested in how much school actually matters in terms of the kind of outcome, the attainment outcomes or whatever that the students end up with. Because I would imagine there's kind of 3 big factors into play. There's obviously genetics, there's the home environment, and then there's the school environment, to really simplify things. Do you have a sense of the relative proportions of those in terms of the influence that they would have on kind of academic outcomes when it comes to maths?
So, I'm not going to give you numbers if that's what you're hoping that I was going to do. So one thing is, I don't think that's a question that has an answer. I don't think that research can give you those percentages. Any particular study might come up with some estimates from their own sample and the own things they've measured, but I don't think we can generalize that. One of the things is that these are not 3 separate influences, that they interact, and therefore it's just not possible to tie things back to one particular influence. I think that there is some good research. So there was a long scale project in the UK for a number of years called the EPI project, which was looking at preschool education and the impact of preschool education. And that's certainly, large scale across the UK, estimated that, yes, children going to preschool and the quality of the preschool did have an impact, a measurable impact on children's maths learning. The home environment did as well. But also we know that there are these big individual differences in children's cognitive skills, and those seem to have an impact as well. So I think all of this does. I think it's just such a very complex kind of jigsaw puzzle of different things that have influence. And some of those things are things that we can do something about. And some of those are things that it's harder to do something about. So, we might be able to change some of the activities children get to do in preschool. We probably can't change children's working memory capacity. And so one of the jobs of research, I think, is to identify what are the influences that are causal, what are the things that are associated with outcomes that are causally associated, and also which of those are manipulable, which of those can we actually do something about, and then to think about what's the most effective way of doing that. And I just think at the moment, in terms of research on mathematical cognition and maths learning has massively increased over the last 20 years. But we're still at the point where we have lots and lots of things that we know are associated with outcomes, and we don't have a good feel for which of those are causally associated, and of those, which of those can we actually do something about? And so that's the kind of next challenge for research, I think, before we can have really good impact.
Love it. That's fascinating. That's brilliant. My kind of last question about the kind of centre and the work that you're doing, but as I say, feel free to add anything else after this, is what would be an example of something that you're going to be working on soon, or so, or colleagues are going to be working on that you're particularly excited about? Is it a particular study, a particular area? What's exciting you at the moment that's coming up?
Oh, there's lots of things. I mean, the stuff that I'm individually working on with 2-year-olds is really exciting me, but I think that's quite a niche thing. I think one of the really big things that we want to contribute, which will be coming up in the next kind of 12 months we're putting in place, is As I just said, we know a lot about what's associated with outcomes, and particularly in primary school, but we don't know which of those are causally associated. So we're going to be running some randomized controlled trials in primary schools, looking at actually, can we do that job of identifying whether something that's associated with maths learning is actually causing that maths learning. So we're going to be running some large-scale RCTs on that. But it's really important to say that one of the problems I think we have with a lot of education research at the moment is that we have lots of RCTs being run and we have lots of evaluation trials, and we're not always clear about the purpose of them. So whether they are being done to test whether something is a causal factor, or whether they're being done to try out something to see if it works in classroom. And what we're doing is trying to separate those out very clearly. So we kind of do some randomized controlled trials where we can see that under certain circumstances, it is possible to change this and see an impact on that. And then we say, right, okay, well, if we know that that is theoretically possible now we say, what can that look like in the classroom? And we work with teachers to think about how that can be most effective. So we're kind of trying to very deliberately separate out those stages that I think in a lot of the work that's a lot of randomized control trials are not clear enough about which of those bits they're trying to do.
Got it. Brilliant stuff. Was there anything else about the centre that we haven't covered that you wanted listeners to be aware of, Camilla?
I don't know, I think we've covered it quite well. I guess the other bit that we're doing is stuff around research communication. But I think you might have already talked to my colleague Paul about some of those kind of bits. So you'll have to go and listen to Paul's session to hear about that. But actually, I'm also really excited about that, the idea of doing some research on the research communication process itself. So actually, rather than us all trying to guess what good research communication it is, let's actually try and test out some different approaches and see what is effective.
Fascinating. That's brilliant. Right. Well, one more question from me and then it's over to you for your big three. So final reflection, what's an example of something important that you've changed your mind about, Camilla?
I think it is about the stuff that we're just touching on in the end, actually, about the idea of how research evidence can be used. So certainly when I started off as a researcher and encouraged to think about, you know, you should always end your papers with a paragraph about what the educational implications of your study is. And I just think we shouldn't be thinking in terms of the educational implications of individual studies. Research is really, really complex. It's really messy. It's really nuanced. Individual studies are very unlikely to have enough in them for us to say anything at all about education. And actually what we need to be doing is we need to be using research studies to come up with a better understanding of the theory. And then you think about, well, what does that theory mean for the classroom? And it's very rare that an individual research study is able to do that. So I kind of push back a bit about the idea that we should be thinking about the implications of individual studies. Does it make sense to talk about the findings of individual studies for teachers? I think it, you know, it gives you something tangible to talk about, but actually I think often that ends up with you're overinterpreting a single study beyond what it can handle.
Interesting. Love it. All right, Camilla, over to you for your big three. And as listeners will be aware, there'll be links to each of these in the show notes. So these could be blogs, papers, books, anything you like. What should we check out?
Okay, well, so I sort of thought about a few different things are kind of to some extent linked to what we're doing in the centre. So one is a website. So you mentioned earlier, I was asked whether there's anyone else doing anything similar to us. And I think one of the closest things is a network in the US called the DREAM Network. So it's Development and Research in Early Mathematics Education. So they've got a website that is full of lots of resources and activities and videos. And so both for early years and kind of for early primary. So that's a really good one to look at, and it's all free on there, so you can go and get what you want.
They've nailed the acronym there as well, haven't they, with that one?
Better than ours. You know, never mind. Then two other things that are a bit more kind of summaries of research. So as I was just saying, I don't think we should be thinking about individual studies. So a couple of different summaries of research, and one's a pretty old one and then one's a much newer one. So I don't know whether any of your previous podcast interviewees have mentioned this, but one of the old one that I think is still stands the test of time and is really good is a report for the Nuffield Foundation back in 2008 about key understandings in mathematics learning. And this is a number of different papers that focuses on numbers, arithmetic, algebra, problem solving. But what's particularly unique about it, I think, is it really focuses on understanding, which I think sometimes that gets lost a bit in all the talk about skills and knowledge. And so I think that's really nice. So those are all written by Terezina Nunes, Peter Bryant and Anne Watson. So some familiar names there, I'm sure. And then the last one is a much more recent research review by Nancy Jordan and colleagues, published last year. And this is actually quite a brief research review, so it's quite readable. And this is really focusing on the complexity of early number understanding. So that's about core foundations of early mathematics. And I think it's nice because it unpicks, they use this idea of number sense, and it unpicks what number sense really means and how complex it is for children to understand numbers and number relations and things like that. So those are my three.
Wow. Plenty for us to check out there. That's brilliant. Well, this has been brilliant, Camilla. We were worried. We didn't know whether we'd be able to have enough to talk about here because, as you say, the centre's new and it's all about stuff that's coming up. But I felt that was absolutely fascinating. Loads of stuff to think about and reflect on, and loads of things to be excited about what's coming up in the future. So, Camilla Gilmore, thank you once again for joining me today.
Great. Thanks, Craig.